At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing or
politics,
country music,
hockey,
sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.
من لیلا هستم، طرفدار و شنونده ایر هاسل از لندن. My name is Leila. I'm a long-time fan and listener of ایر هاسل from London. این قسمت از ایر هاسل حاوی زبان و محتوایی است که ممکن است برای همه شنوندگان مناسب نباشد. The following episode of ایر هاسل contains language and content that may not be suitable for all listeners. Discretion is advised.
It's really good to have you back.
Great to be back, man.
I know it is.
This is my Brody, Richard Solomon.
Wait a minute. What's Brody?
Brody, my brother, my buddy, my homie.
Nice. Okay, got it.
And he's a professional basketball player who was playing ball in Japan when he got picked up for possessing CBD vape pens.
Oh, I'm not surprised. I lived in Japan. They are serious.
He spent almost 5 months alone in a prison cell. Pretty much nothing to do but sit and wait for time to pass by.
Mm.
Sometimes I just lay down and just breathe, literally just focus on my breathing. And I would breathe through every inch or limb of my body, from my toes to the soles of my feet, to my ankles, to my calves, to my shins, to my knees, to the back of my knees, to the sides of my knees, my hamstrings, to my quads, to my glutes, to my groins, to my private organs, to my stomach, to my back, my upper back, my lower back, my middle back, my shoulders, my biceps, my triceps, my elbows, my forearms, my fingers, my palms, my neck, my ears, my eyes, my mouth, each hair follicle on my head.
Richard doesn't speak Japanese.
Which means he doesn't read it either.
Nah, he couldn't communicate with the guards.
Right.
He couldn't communicate with the guys in the other cell. He had no idea what was going on
right. And
had no one to talk to but himself.
We had like a small little mirror, so I would look in the mirror, and in the morning I just talk to myself like, man, how are you doing? Somebody had to ask me how I was doing. If I didn't do it, who was going to do it? Nobody was going to be able to do it. Man, you tired? I'm tired as hell, man. But it's all right, though. We're going to get through it. Just one more day. You got through another day already.
I'm Earline Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. And on today's show, what it's like to be locked up in a country thousands of miles from home.
Where you don't know no one, can't speak the lingo, you're just alone.
This is Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Hi, I am Pete Rolls. I am from L.A., and I'm currently in Valley Center, north side of San Diego.
And we're in the city right now when we're talking to you.
We're sitting in the cool shade of the avocado grove. Sorry if you hear any of the dogs are rustling in the leaves here. I'm living and working on an 80-acre farm, and I've been here since the beginning of the year.
Oh.
It's been an amazing place to kind of transition from, you know, back to society.
The reason we tapped in with Pete is we wanted to hear about something that happened to him when he was just a youngster, just starting out.
Pete had always been interested in film, especially the gear side, like behind the camera stuff. So he was building that career and actually doing pretty well.
I was a technician doing sound and video work. I got on a movie called Hangover 2.
Where the hell are you?
We're in Bangkok.
Hala, city of Kuala.
I found myself in Thailand and fell in love with it. It's a different world out there, you know, and for the certain desires and compulsions that I had kind of already fallen into, that place became like just a mecca for being a bad boy.
And what are these compulsions that you're talking about?
Well, I mean, you know, sex, drugs, alcohol, partying, just doing what you want, when you want, how you want. And I went off the rails. I was in the depths of addiction.
If myself and Nigel had met you on the streets of Bangkok the day before your arrest, who would we have met?
Man, I probably wouldn't have been asleep for the previous 4 days. And I wouldn't have been able to look you in the eye. I wouldn't have been able to form a clear sentence. I might have been thinking about how I could manipulate you. Maybe you're a tourist that I could take advantage of. Maybe I even bring my team of locals in and they drug you and we rob you, you know?
That's the level you were at?
It got to that point.
Pete had lost his job. He was basically just supporting himself by conning tourists and dealing drugs.
To make deliveries, he was using an app called Grab Taxi, you know, kind of like Uber Eats or DoorDash. But one day, a driver got suspicious about a package Pete had sent out.
There had been a huge bombing the month before there at an actual Buddhist temple. So this delivery guy was scared that he was somehow participating in a bombing. So he decided to open up the package. He saw that there was ice in there, and he contacted the police. So, of course, they had my address from the order, and they stormed right on in.
This wasn't Pete's first run-in with the Thai police, so he kind of knew the drill.
They hold you in the police station for several days. That's usually a time when you can negotiate with them to, you know, pay a bribe. I hadn't spoken with my mom for quite some time, that I was, ashamed and just didn't want to hear it. I called her, and I asked her to send a bunch of money, and she said no.
We're excited. We don't get to speak to a lot of moms.
I imagine.
Nah, definitely.
Pete's mom, Linda, lives outside Palm Springs in the California desert. And during her career, she worked as an assistant for really big-time musicians. And Erlon, you know I really wanted to know who she worked for. I tried.
But she wasn't a fiend. No. She wasn't giving up nothing. She was tight-lipped on this one.
Yes, indeed. But she did tell us that she and Pete were really close.
How old is he now?
In my head, he's 7, but he is 42.
42, okay. He's your only child?
He is.
How was it when he moved to Thailand? How did you feel about that?
Horrible. When he told me, well, he first went to work on a movie, on a film. What was that? Hangover? And that was fine. But then when he wanted to go back, I said, you know, I don't think it's a good idea. I just knew it was not going to be good.
Sometimes Pete would call Linda and be really drunk and yelling at her. Other times she wouldn't hear from him for months.
I used to send him money, Western Union, for food, knowing that he wasn't really going to buy food, hoping he was going to buy food. And at one point he said, don't send me any more money. I'm just going to use it. I'm going to get drugs. Do you sleep with your phone 24/7 glued to you? And I just, you know, I lit my candle twice a day and did my prayers for him. That's when I said, okay, God, he is in your hands. I've done everything I can do. You know, I had to let it go.
Linda hadn't heard from Pete in a year when she got that call from the police station.
When he first called me, he said, oh, you know, you need to send so much money to this person. And it was a good chunk of money to a person I don't even know. No, I'm not going to do that.
The cops let Pete call the U.S. Embassy, but the embassy told him that there wasn't anything that they could do for him. They told him they'd come see him in prison.
So after a couple days in the police station, they pick you up in one of their prison trucks. You're in there with a lot of other hard-up men and women. You don't know where you're going. There's no explanation. They're just kind of yelling at you to go in this direction, to get in, to sit down. There's no questions that you can ask. There's no information passed on. I went to a place called, the slang name is called Bombat. It's the Central Institute for Drug Addicts. And I was in there sitting on the cold ground in a prison uniform, didn't know anybody. I was detoxing very hard. First of all, there was constant tattooing going on. They're using these sewing needles. They will tie them together, put them on a long stick, bribe the officials for some printer ink, and they'll be tattooing their faces, tattooing their eyeballs, I mean, all kinds of crazy stuff like that. Of course, they're sharing needles. Part of the culture of this kind of drug underground was that they did these penis modifications with very dirty utensils. They were slicing their penises and injecting them with Vaseline to make them look bigger, apparently. I saw many people die from this.
Can you describe what the sleeping quarters was like? Can you just describe that whole little scene?
They're all open air rooms. There's actually not really any walls because it's so hot there, right? So there's, you say, 200 people in there, and your legs are scissor locked in with another prisoner's who's sleeping across from you with his head on the opposite side. There's a poster of slave ships. It's exactly that way. Mm. There's never any space to not be in contact with someone, which obviously that took time to get used to.
Pete and the other guys were locked in there from 2 in the afternoon until 6 a.m. the next day when they could finally go down to the yard. Erlon, 16 hours in that tiny space with nowhere to go. I mean, I couldn't get my head around that.
If you need to go to the hole at the end of the room to use the toilet, you're walking over all these sets of crossed legs. People do get pissed about if you touch their leg while you're trying to walk. Taking a shower with a small bowl was something I'd never done before. There's no privacy. There's no room to be shy. So you're kind of like, you know, rubbing up next to and all around you other men that are naked trying to get a bowl of water to throw over your head and clean yourself. If you showed that you were uncomfortable, that would give other prisoners more of a reason to heckle you and maybe punk you. And so you kind of had to just bite the bullet and jump in there and act like this stuff wasn't fazing you.
And the food he described, Nige, I would definitely be hella skinny right now.
You would be a little slip.
The prison food that they provide you is basically white rice. And the soup that goes along with that is either the outer layer of a pig with the hair still in it. So there's no meat. Mm. It's not even the fat. It's just the thick layer of the pig's skin, which I could never get that one down. Or then the other one would be chicken feet, which aren't so bad, actually.
So that was the same food over and over again, were those three basic?
Yeah, until you have money. At the risk of sounding dramatic, it was the first time that I felt like, wow, is this what starvation feels like?
Being hungry, being alone, I think that's kind of like the universal prison experience.
Mm.
When you first get there, you feel like everyone else has found their place, found their people,
right.
You know, and you're the outsider.
Yeah, totally. But finally, things started to turn around for him. For one thing, Pete's mom figured out how to send him money.
Yep. And just like any prison anywhere, Nige, you gotta have a source of income, some type of money, because you need it in prison.
Once you have money on your account, then you're styling. You can get some really good food, which is not part of the actual official system there. The whole prison is an actual living community. The guards are called commandos. They all live in there. Their wives will cook up wonderful Thai food every day and package it. You can order a really nice, original Thai food meal for a $1. And, you order a couple of those and share them with your mates or your friends.
Those friends? That's the second good thing that finally happened to Pete.
Yeah, it all started when this guy yelled out to him in the yard, Erlon, in the most delightful way.
And he just said, "Were you made in the USA?" And I'm like, "What?" He goes, "Were you made in the USA?" I'm like, "Yeah, I'm an American." He goes, "I grew up in LA." And I'm like, "Whoa, that's crazy, man. I'm from LA too." I couldn't believe it. It was unbelievable. Like, wow. And he just said, "Yeah, if you want to roll with us, we'll take care of you. You buy some food every day and my boys will take care of all the laundry. You'll be safe. No one messes with you in here."
Pete found his gang, his crew, his posse he was in.
It's called your bond. Mine was about 8 guys, and everybody contributed in some way to the house, your family, and you look out for each other. You don't care about anybody else. You take care of each other, and you eat together, you coexist together. That was a huge blessing for me. We were living pretty large, you know. I was taking care of my group. So I was spending, you know, I would say $15 a day. We'd have a big feast for lunch. We'd have certain items that we could keep left over for the next day, eat them at breakfast. I did gain a lot of weight in there.
It took a year for Pete's case to make it through the Thai court system. Back in L.A., Linda was talking to lawyers, talking to the embassy, pulling every string she could think of to try to get her son out of prison.
At the beginning, there was no way that I just couldn't accept the fact that I couldn't fix it. Because that was my job. I could fix anything. I could make something happen out of nothing. In the middle of the night, if somebody needed something, I could do it. But this is the end of the road. I couldn't.
Eventually, Pete received his sentence, 7.5 years.
Pete and Linda stayed in touch through letters. Linda's were taking months to reach him, so she hired an attorney in Thailand who would print them out and bring them to the prison for Pete.
Sometimes Linda wouldn't get a letter from her son for weeks. Sometimes she'd get 5 in one day. She still has a big stack of them at her house.
Now it's 8 p.m. Schedule is 15-hour lockdown. Then 7 a.m. down to the yard. There goes my family. It's small, just 5 of us, but exceptionally ideal. We sleep on the floor, but 3 blankets makes a bed. There's a flat-screen TV playing movies and TV shows until 9 p.m. It's really not so bad, but then again, I'm not looking at 25 to life like most of the others in this den. I love you, Mom. I really do. I just finished Eric Clapton's autobiography. It was left by a foreigner in the library here. What an ocean of suffering he has suffered. He has survived, but he pulled through just like I will. It hit me like a ton of bricks just how much of a prick I am by not keeping my own mother as a top priority. Really fell apart today somehow, even though crying is a bad idea in here.
Were the letters ever, like, a little too much for you? Like, was there some part of you, you know, that wanted to hold back or maybe know a little less?
Thank you, yes. Sometimes it's too hard to read. There was a lot of really good stuff, but there were days and I just thought, oh.
What were you trying to protect in yourself?
I had to stay strong. I couldn't break down. I had to fight. I had to hold this together. This is my baby.
And there's this whole financial side to what Linda's going through.
Yeah, and that's the side that no one sees.
Like, how much do you send monthly in a foreign prison, to a foreign prison?
Maybe $1,200. And then I paid $500 for the attorney.
Every month?
Yes.
Wow. Well, what did you give up for yourself in order to make that happen?
I mortgaged my house. Yeah, my savings, my retirement. Oh, my girlfriend, bless her heart, I love her. I said, oh man, this is going to cost a fortune. And she said, listen, you have to rob a bank, I'll go with you.
Do you think he understood what a financial strain this was for you?
You know, at the time, I didn't want to even go there. I didn't want him to feel any more guilt. No, he probably didn't.
Was there any part of you that resented it?
Yeah, of course. Yeah. Believe me, I got a bill to give him.
Yeah, I mean, is he going to take care of you?
You bet
now
he is.
It's his turn. Yeah.
You bet he is. You do it because I love him and I want to see him again. And who else is going to do it? I knew I was feeding not just Pete, I was feeding all of them. They used to send me cards. This one inmate said he was from Cambodia. He was there 9 years and he never received a letter or a card. He had no family, had nobody. So I wrote him a letter. You know, then he would write me and they'd call me mom. And, you know, when some of the inmates got out, they would call me from India, Cambodia, England, and they still write me.
What I'm hearing is like, this was almost like a job for you. You're sending money to your son. You're finding ways to get letters to him. You're trying to take care of other people there. You're making calls to other people's family. Like this, did this just take over your life?
Yes, it did. It was daily. It took over a lot of my life. I really retreated because it's not like I really felt like I could go have a social life and party. And you can't see friends and tell them in a few minutes, oh, how's Pete? Well, you know, you're not going to say in 5 minutes, well, you know, tell them the story. So I really withdrew a lot. Just the stress of it all definitely took a toll.
You know what, Nige?
What?
It's time to get to my favorite part of this story.
So I was driving. I did a lot of trips in those years from L.A. to where I live in the Coachella Valley. I was put on public radio, and then I hear this story about a prisoner, and I just turned it. I said, man, I do not want to hear any more prison stories. Turn that sucker off, you know? Then I'm driving a little while. Well, I'm curious now. What's going on there?
You know, one day you may get graham crackers.
I started listening, and it was really a good program.
Banana sandwich, jelly sandwich, and those are the best sandwiches.
Earlonne, a really good program.
Great.
You might be right.
Really? I mean, is that your favorite sandwich?
No, that's like the easiest go-to sandwich.
Called Ear Hustle.
I've heard of that. Yeah, a public radio station was broadcast in one of our episodes, and Linda just happened to catch it.
What do you think made you keep listening?
Well, because it was a positive thing. It was somebody telling the story of how, you know, how they made it through. That they were still standing and they were still having, you know, their experience in life.
So she found the transcripts, printed out an episode, and she sent it to me. And I read it, and I'm like, wow, this is so cool. So I, of course, asked her for more. And I said, send as many as you can.
He wrote me back. He said, that's so great. Everyone loves it. We love it. Kept printing them and sending them to him.
When the mail came, which was ever very, very rarely, maybe once every week and a half or so, we passed it around to all the other foreigners. And everybody was taking turns, four or five episodes at a time. And I'd delegate them out. Okay, you know, when you finish with that one, pass it to him. I'd see my guy that was in another room. Hey, did you read that one part of the story? Oh, that was so great. Oh, how about this side? How about that guy? You know, and one transcript was probably read by, you know, over 20, 25 people. We had this form of entertainment that was relative to our life and actually put things in a very interesting perspective. And it got us connected with other prisoners just through the text on a page.
Pete starts thinking, maybe we would want to know more about him.
I'm overseas, and we're in this dungeon, and we're really enjoying your show, but we don't have radios.
I totally remember getting his letter. In fact, Earlonne...
Oh, you got it right here.
Of course, yeah. I have it right here. You know I keep everything archived. This is in a little its own little plastic sleeve.
Damn.
Dear Ear Hustlers, PR here, writing from Bangkok's Bombat Drug Prison. Just wanted to tell you that we've been getting printouts of your show, and it's great for us to read, locked up here abroad. Myself, I'm American, but dudes here are from all over the world. England, France, Germany, Colombia, Peru, China, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, you name it. Thailand is real drug central. But we appreciate whoever it is over there who's in charge of transcribing your show, so people like us without the privilege of radio can still enjoy and even be part of it. Hint, hint, if you all could give us a shout out in the future, that would be really great.
And you know what? Pete got his shout out. This was back in season 4.
Okay, this is really cool. You know how we have listeners send us letters?
Yeah.
Well, we got this letter from a woman whose son is serving time in a prison in Thailand.
Shout out to the guys in Thailand, man.
I can't wait till they read that in the transcript.
And sure enough, you guys gave me that shout out. We got the transcript of that episode and we were like, damn, we're on the radio in America, man. Like everybody's tripping out and like, that's pretty cool. Like nobody would have imagined that.
It was just so amazing when your mom wrote to us and told about that. It really was, I think, blew all of our minds and made us really happy. So thank you. It's really incredible. For years, Pete had been on a list for a prison treaty transfer.
This is when countries agree to send a foreigner back to their home country so they can serve out the remainder of their sentence there.
So Pete was eligible and ready to go. But there was this one other guy ahead of him.
Months went by, didn't hear anything. And one day I was eating my breakfast. They called my name over the loudspeaker in Thai. They said, you know, pack your things. You're going now. All my family's yelling, yay, yay. Everybody's going, oh, wow, wow. People are coming up and giving me hugs and slapping me on the back. And I was just in shock. And so I just dropped everything and gave my few possessions away to my friends. And they handed me over, you know, as a prisoner from their system into the hands of the DOJ.
It wasn't until Pete got home that he found out what had happened to the other guy in the Thai prison, the one who was ahead of him on that list to get transferred.
Federal prison guards came to his building to pick him up, and he was sick. He had diarrhea. He was vomiting. And they said, no way. We can't take this guy. Somehow, on that day, they managed to change all the travel documents, the visas, the tickets, everything into my name, like within the hour. And that was the reason why they picked me up spur of the moment without any forewarning. 2 days later, COVID hit officially and they shut the whole thing down. And that other American, that other American got stuck there and he's still there now. One day I'd like to find him and thank him and tell him sorry, man.
It was February 28th, 2020. I'm driving and the phone rings and I see this number, 800 number come up. I think, I'm not going to answer it. It's one of those calls. And then I thought, oh, okay, let me see who it is. And then they said, this is some prison. I didn't know who it was. So-and-so has a collect call for you. Will you accept? And I thought, who in the heck? And he said, hey, it's me. I said, who? He says, Mom, it's me. He goes, I'm here in L.A. I said, oh, man, let me pull over. I'm going to crash this car.
Pete had been taken to the Metropolitan Detention Center in downtown Los Angeles to carry out the rest of his sentence.
Which turned out to be just 7 weeks after the judge factored in the time he'd already served in Thailand. When Pete was finally released, his mom was there to pick him up.
He just lost it, you know. He fell at my feet and cried. And we just had the biggest embrace and hug, and it was great. He looked full of light.
And, like, how were you? Were you, did you feel lighter? Did you move differently?
Yes, all of the above. All of the above.
Do you remember, like, waking up in the middle of the night and being like, yep, he's here.
Oh, yeah. I'd say, oh, my God. All this time, I didn't know where he was, and now he's in the room next door. He's there.
Did you ever go in and, like, peep at him sleeping or anything?
Oh,
like
sure.
That?
Yeah, to go in there and see him there and his chest breathing and his, you know, comfortable. And I know he had a good dinner. And, yeah, that's a mother's dream, still checking on their baby, right?
Erlon,
yes.
We're going to take a quick break.
So please stick around.
Support for Ear Hustle comes from Odoo. If you feel like you're wasting time and money with your current business software or just want to know what you could be missing, then you need to join the millions of other users who switched to Odoo. Odoo is the affordable all-in-one management software with a library of fully integrated business applications that help you get more done in less time for a fraction of the price. To learn more, visit odoo.com/earhustle. That's odoo.com/earhustle. Odoo, modern management made simple. The next generation of influential Black voices can be found on NPR's new collection, Black Stories, Black Truths. Black Stories, Black Truths is a celebration of Blackness from NPR. Each of NPR's Black voices are as distinct, varied, and nuanced as the Black experience itself. In the Black Stories, Black Truths collection, you'll hear stories of joy, resilience, empowerment, and creating world-shifting things out of struggle. Every episode is a living account about what it means to be Black today, told from a unique Black perspective. From Bobby Shmurda to The Wire, Michelle Obama to reparations, there's no limit to the range of Black stories, Black truths. Black perspectives haven't always been centered in the telling of America's story. Now they are the story. Hear a feed from episodes across NPR podcasts that center Black voices. Stories should never be about us without us. Listen now to Black Stories, Black Truths from NPR, wherever you get your podcasts.
If we had met you in June 2009, can you tell me about the person that we would have met? Who do we have sat down and had a cup of coffee with?
Woo, okay. The person I was in 2009, I was passionate and I was angry. I was very kind of destroyed by the failure of our movement to stop the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. I was also idealistic and driven to move across the world and discover and create a whole new life in Syria, in the Middle East.
And how old were you?
29.
29, okay. So like that's a real turning point age.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
This is journalist and playwright Sarah Shure.
When you look back at that person you were at 29, what sorts of feelings do you have?
Definitely have a sense of loss, feeling of how much we've lost in the interim in our world. That the sort of anything seemed possible. Like when I was 29, I was just like, poof, the world is endless and I'm falling in love with the world.
Some listeners will probably remember hearing about Sarah when her name was in the news in 2010. Erlan, do you remember her?
Yeah, I remember the story. Not every detail, but I do remember it happening.
Yeah, pretty much the same for me. Well, when Sarah was 29, she was living in Syria inside a camp for Palestinian refugees. She was teaching English, studying Arabic, and also working towards a career as a journalist.
And she was also in love with another American journalist named Shane Bauer.
I felt like I'd met my match with him, that we could do anything and go anywhere together. We had a real, like, kind of powerful and expansiveness to our relationship. I mean, I had the most beautiful year of my life in the Middle East before our captivity. Truly, just a year of incredible growth.
In July of 2009, a friend of theirs, Josh Vital, came to visit from the States. And the three of them decided to go on an excursion into northern Iraq to this mountainous area where they thought they could do some nice hiking.
And I know later on, a lot of people were like, what were they thinking?
Mm.
You know, like, mm-hmm. Why would an American be hiking around this part of the world?
Totally. But I think what gets lost in the story is that this part of Iraq was actually really welcoming to Americans.
We spent the night there and had tea from a tea vendor. And the tea vendor pointed out a trail. And there were literally like hundreds of other families camped there. So we felt safe. We felt like we were doing what other people were doing. And they were really welcoming. If we made any mistake, we hiked too far. We had a different concept probably than the tea vendor of what a hike is. We were just taken away by the beauty of the place and each other's company. When we got to the top of the ridge, there was a guard with a gun, and he motioned for us to cross the trail. He pointed to the ground and he said, "Iran." We had no idea that we were anywhere near the Islamic Republic of Iran. There were so many narratives competing in my mind, and one of them was like, oh, come on, this is impossible. I mean, they knew that we weren't doing anything other than just having a hike and a picnic.
When Sarah, Shane, and Josh arrived at prison, the guards took everything from them. All of their clothes, their belongings, and they even took Sarah's glasses.
Mm.
Yeah. So as a glass wearer, that is my worst nightmare. I mean, to be in a scary, unfamiliar place and you can't even see, you are so vulnerable without your glasses.
I know that has to be bad.
Can you try to go back there and just in detail the smells, the textures, the light, the space around you? And again, as I said, if we ask something you don't want to answer.
No, I'm just appreciating your invitation, and I'm finding, you know, trying to find a fresh access to it. And what I remember from entering the cell for the first time is that I was yelling, screaming for Shane and for Josh, and I don't know how long I was yelling, but I remember the feeling of the cell door closing and locking. And there's definitely just like no other feeling like that. The helplessness and the realization, oh shit, I've lost my freedom and there's nothing I can do to get it back. So that first day was, yeah, just a tremendous amount of pain, like physical pain. Anything I would think of that I love or care about, you know, just feeling like just the stabs of physical anguish. It felt like grieving and loss of everything, not knowing if I would ever get it back. Telling myself, of course you're going to get it back. Come on, any day, tomorrow, it's all going to come back. But not knowing if it was going to be 5 years, 10 years, forever.
It's the not knowing how long. Like if you knew, okay, I'm going to be here for 6 months. I can get my mind around this. I can understand that. But the idea of the not knowing, that like just makes my heart race. It makes me so nervous.
Yeah, that is the intolerable of it, the time that has no definition, no meaning. I had to construct a reason so it just didn't feel like I dropped off the earth into an abyss. I want to understand humanity better. I want to understand myself better. I want to be able to understand suffering. I knew that if I was going to be of any use, I would have to just fight and stay vigilant in there and not let myself cross that line into just total desperation or hopelessness. I would just pace and I would cry for a little while and then like force myself to stop crying. Did multiplication tables. That was my early coping mechanism just to stay like focused and grounded and ready.
How many things did you count in the cell?
Oh, cracks, the number?
No, I'm just saying cracks, dots on the wall.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I know when I've been in these cells, even had honeycomb doors, and you would know how many holes is on that door.
Absolutely.
Because it's so the boredom.
Yeah, I think I used to count every line because there's like two doors. There's the lines on the walls, the lines on the windows. So I would just count lines.
Math can break up the monotony.
Yeah. And you know, I counted my body parts like, hello, finger. It's more than counting. It was like each part of my body was a friend, had its own identity.
Can you describe the actual space?
It was about 8 by 10 feet, I would guess. And the window was high up and it was covered in a metal plate, perforated metal plate. And the sunlight would come in through the perforated metal plate and cast a beam onto the wall, which moved in an arc across the cell throughout the day. And it's how I kept track of time.
Beyond examining yourself and going inside, was the movement of the light like the only physical curiosity that happened in the cell?
When I was taken out to the, what they call here, the dog room or the open air cell, there we called it habohori, the place where you eat air. I collected leaves and little things that blew in. I had a sort of altar that I made out of the scraps of things from the trash in one corner of my cell.
Erlan, you know I totally understand that urge to find something beautiful and something intentional, something connective, especially in such a cold, isolated place.
Yeah, I think it's just human nature, you know? We were just talking about this on the last episode. You know, it's like saying, I'm here, I exist.
Oh, absolutely. And Sarah kept finding new ways to do this. Like, pretty regularly, she'd get pulled out of her cell to be interrogated, and eventually she got brave enough to steal a pen from her interrogator.
Yeah, that's
wild, huh?
Dangerous.
Dangerous, but, for sure. Yeah. I remember when she was telling us this, I was getting very nervous. But so anyway, she would use the pen when she got back to her cell to create decorations on the back of her door. So she'd go back into her memory and reproduce things like a little cottage where she had spent time by a marsh with pussy willows. And
you got to imagine how much time that took. That just filled her day, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was the only visual decoration she had in her cell.
No, there were no colors. I mean, yeah, it's the gray, limitless ocean of time stretched out in every direction. And I spent a lot of time with my eyes closed trying to imagine things. Imagine what my mother looks like. I think, if I'm honest, I spent a lot of time just dealing with a tremendous amount of anger and rage. In prison, it was useful to be angry. Because if you're sad, you fall apart. And if you fall too deep into a hole, you may never get out.
From time to time, her interrogator would give her something, like a notebook or some photos printed out from a website. But she wasn't really told anything about where these objects came from or why she was getting them.
So she would come up with her own theory.
I was given a beautiful headscarf, this purple headscarf that I decided was from my mother. That was the most beautiful color in my cell, that purple scarf.
Yeah. When you saw that color, I'm just wondering like how you responded to it, like how did it fill you emotionally? And then you thought it was from your mom. Did you imagine like her smell on the scarf, or did you put it on and imagine it was your mom hugging you, or?
I wish it was that kind of sweet and simple, the memory I have of the scarf. I remember the scarf coming in at a time of extreme desperation when my interrogators told me that the U.S. wasn't going to do anything for us and that we weren't going to be taken to trial and that we could be there for a very long time. I came back to the cell and really got the closest I've ever gotten to crossing that line into insanity and desperation. It was one of the most terrifying moments of my life. And that's what I think of when I think of that scarf.
Sarah's isolation dragged on and on. A whole year passed.
There were days when the old Sarah started to emerge, you know, the activist, the fighter.
I think that really started to happen when I found ways to communicate with the other women inside. So in the beginning, it was knocking on the walls, our shared walls. And not just knocking, but like coming up with rhythms and then repeating them and then like adding to the rhythm and creating music together. I sang at the top of my lungs, I sang Mercedes Sosa's song, Gracias a la Vida, every morning. And all the other women in the hallway would clap. I came up with dance moves.
That's what I was going to ask you. Did you have some good dance moves?
Oh, yeah. Lots of dancing. For a while, I was a nudist in there. I just decided, like, this is a way to say fuck you to the guards, to shock them with my nudity. I was the only one in isolation in my corridor. Some of the women were many. There were many women in one cell, and they knew it. They all knew about me. And it felt amazing to be known about. They would sing songs to me. and we could have conversations down the hallway. I just got into this, like, no bullshit kind of relationship with the guards. Like, this guard that I called Mask Lady, she used to always put my food on the floor and make me pick it up. And I started refusing food until she would hand it to me. And then I started refusing food until she would say good morning to me. Because I was like, you can't just come to my cell with that face and not acknowledge my humanity. I'm not going to eat.
What about on the harder days?
I heard of women being beaten, which they would never do to me because I was a valuable prisoner and they, you know, didn't want to leave any marks. But I felt like I heard screaming and I was just losing my mind. And I just was praying that the screaming would stop and feeling a tremendous amount of hatred for the person screaming because I couldn't handle the pain. The guards burst into my cell and started to shake me, and I realized it was me. I was screaming. That's the only time in my life I've ever lost it to that degree. And it scares the shit out of you.
So what was the longest you went without seeing Josh and Shane?
It was at least a month.
Okay.
They knew which hallway I was in, mm-hmm. so they would like yell my name. Just knowing that they were in the same building and that they were going through the same reality, that they were in the same boat. I wasn't alone, even though I was physically alone.
I read at a point that it really bothered you to have them use the word we. And I'm just curious about that use, like, language, if you could talk about that, like, that what it felt like to hear them talk about we when you weren't. Maybe not feeling like a we.
Yeah, I mean, I think that prison activates your core wounds, right? Like whatever core wounds you have from childhood, those are going to kind of define your daily experience and your emotional life. One of my core wounds from childhood is just being different than everyone else and not fitting in. And so in prison, when Shane and Josh got put together, I could feel how their energy shifted. I mean, jealous is not even a word. All day long, I would think about what they're doing that I can't do and what they're feeling that I can't feel. Am I ever going to be a we again? Am I ever going to get to do anything with anybody else that I can then talk about?
Yeah.
In those situations, your mind really start playing tricks on you.
Could you relate to that?
Yeah. Yeah. You start to feel that you're not a part of what's going on.
Mm.
You know, feel like you excluded or you're not in those conversations.
I woke up one morning and that light that I described to you coming through the window that would move in an arc throughout the day. Often I would wake up hours before and just agonize waiting for the light to come in. And this morning it was already shining when I opened my eyes and I could see all of these dust motes floating around inside of it. And each dust mote to me represented someone in my life or just someone that I hadn't met yet and maybe would never meet. And I thought, if I just disappeared, the whole thing will go on without me and it'll be okay. Mm. And on one hand, it's like a beautiful vision of acceptance and, you know, letting go, surrendering. And on the other hand, in that is also just a realization, like, I don't know how if I can go on with this forever.
In September 2010, Sarah was released after 410 days of solitary confinement.
Iran said it was letting her out on humanitarian grounds,
mm-hmm.
but they kept Shane and Josh in prison.
So Sarah, after all those months of total isolation, Earlonne, it's suddenly the opposite. I mean, she's everywhere, lobbying politicians. She's on the news. She's being interviewed. Can you imagine what it's like to go from that drab, isolated place and all of a sudden everybody wants a piece of you?
Actually, I almost can.
Mm. But for her, the only thing that mattered was getting her friends out of prison.
I came out of prison with unbelievable determination and focus. The only thing that mattered to me is getting Shane and Josh out of prison. I was like a machine, like a robot. I didn't feel much of anything. I felt emotionally burned to a crisp. And I kind of liked it because I was like, I don't need these emotions. I have a job to do. I have to get these guys out of prison.
Mm. And how did you physically present yourself at that time?
I was in the media all the time. So I was trying to look kind of normal for the first time in my life. I was trying to appeal to, like, America.
She had a business suit on.
I mean, you know, during that time, I went on Oprah. I met with Obama. I had many meetings with Hillary Clinton. And so I was just trying to play the game, which I wasn't very good at as far as style was concerned. I was just wearing slacks and button shirts and, like, right, you know, trying to...
Like
just,
bland. Like bland?
Was, yeah, like bland. Yeah, I think I didn't really... It took a while for the color to come back into my life. I felt guilty. I hear that from so many formerly incarcerated people to have gotten out first. The only way I could justify my freedom or my existence was deprivation. I didn't drink. You know, I exercised, you know, just way too much. And I just worked, 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 worked. And I think that that was a real sense of guilt and not like, I don't deserve to enjoy this. Not yet.
I understand the sentiment of that, but I don't ever feel guilty.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, me and my co-defendant, we got the same amount of time. My sentence got commuted at the 21 years, and
right,
I'm out. And he's still in there to this very day. But, Nige, I can say I don't feel guilty because I worked hella hard to get out.
Totally.
You know what I'm saying? And being paralyzed by guilt, that don't help shit.
Exactly. And you're still helping, guys.
Yes, definitely. I mean, they need me on this side to do that.
Yeah, that's true. A year after Sarah got out, Shane and Josh were released as well. And since then, Sarah's really devoted herself to ending mass incarceration.
Yep. She's created a play about solitary confinement called The Box. There's going to be a national tour starting in the spring.
So Sarah's still very much out in the world, but those bland pants and button-downs, Earlonne, they're definitely gone. Okay, I'm going to have to ask you this one more time. So it's 2021, we're having coffee. So can you describe who you are now and just how you present?
Can you answer this one for me, Nigel?
No, I just can't. Yeah, I can if you want. Just
yeah, say. Yeah, go
okay.
for it.
You have a lightness to you, and you seem like you have a life that's full of love. You have great style. You're sexy in a nice way, in a way that just says I feel my life. Does any of that resonate with you?
You said lightness. I love those parts of me to be seen by you right now, and I also want to add that, like, I'm also very angry. You know, there's parts of my personality that are hard for people, even the people that love me the most. I think now that you said it, that there, it's not a contradiction to be sparkly and to be angry. You got to have that slow burning fire in you.
So, Nige.
Yes, my friend.
How are you feeling?
Well, first of all, let me ask you, how do I look?
You look great as always. You know?
Oh, you're sweet. I look like I've been on a 30-day prison diet?
30-day challenge great? Yes, of course. Ripped up and everything.
Ripped up, yes, yes. I'm finally doing push-ups. So, yep, we have finished the 30-day challenge. It's been a pretty wild experience, and I'm looking forward to diving in to, you know, making an episode around it.
Sneak peek, what's the most you felt behind this?
Well, I think the most I felt was learning that my ride-or-die partner here loved taunting me with candy when I couldn't eat it. But what I think it's been really interesting, all the conversations we've been having around it with the people out here on the team and the guys inside who have been supporting the project.
Okay.
So we're going to dive into all of that when we put the episode out in December.
I'm looking forward to that episode.
Me too.
This episode of Ear Hustle was produced by Nigel Poor, Earlonne Woods, Rashan, New York Thomas, John Yahya Johnson, Rashid Zinnemann, Bruce Wallace, and Tony Tafoya.
It was sound designed and engineered by Antoine Williams, with music by Antoine and Rashid Zinnemann. Amy Standen edits the show. Shubnam Sigmund is our digital producer, and Julie Shapiro is the executive producer for Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle would also like to thank Warden Ron Broomfield, and as you know, every episode of Ear Hustle has to be approved by this guy here.
This is Lieutenant Sam Robinson, the Public Information Officer at San Quentin, and I do approve this episode.
This podcast was made possible with support from the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative, working to redesign the justice system by building power and opportunity for communities impacted by incarceration.
Ear Hustle is a proud member of Radiotopia from PRX. Radiotopia is a collection of independent, listener-supported podcasts. Some of the best podcasts around.
Hear more at radiotopia.fm.
I'm Nigel Poor.
And I'm Earline Woods.
Thanks for listening.
Nige, Ear Hustle listeners are the best.
They really are. You're always in touch, letting us know what you think about episodes and sharing the love.
Yep, it's really a two-way conversation, a relationship.
Indeed it is. And if you're looking for a way to deepen that relationship, consider signing up for Ear Hustle Plus.
Ear Hustle Plus, it's a new subscription service that delivers bonus Ear Hustle episodes wherever you get your podcasts.
In addition to ad-free episodes of Ear Hustle, subscribers get behind-the-scenes, off-the-cuff conversations.
We have a monthly AMA, which is Ask Me Anything episode, where you and I answer questions sent in by subscribers.
And seriously, no question is too random or wacky.
Questions like, what's our favorite book? Do we hang out in between seasons? What's the most technically challenging Ear Hustle episode ever?
Okay, Earline, yeah, those are good questions, but like we said above, I'd like some wackier ones, actually.
We've also started doing episode commentary, where you and I listen to a classic Ear Hustle episode and talk about how it came together, hard decisions made along the way, and where the people in the episodes are now.
Yeah, we did that for Sellies, and it was a lot of fun, so we're definitely going to do more. And Earline, tell them about that idea you're working on.
Sure. I've been sitting down with some of our formerly incarcerated friends who have gotten out and are doing well. Just basically showing how they went from one situation to a better situation, if that makes sense. Those will start dropping in the Ear Hustle Plus feed soon.
Listeners, we want you in this conversation. Find out more about Ear Hustle Plus at earhustlesq.com/plus or subscribe right now in the Apple Podcast Player app.
That's earhustlesq.com/plus or right in the Apple Podcast Player.
So, what is your favorite book, Earline?
Sorry, Nige. You got to subscribe for that.
Really?
Yes.
Radiotopia. From PR.